So I said, you know what, if I start f***ing with this gun, these guys are gonna get baited. So lo and behold, I picked up Tupac's gun, and immediately one of the outlaws, a guy by the name of Muta, started shooting me. And then I got up and I started shooting him. And before you know it, the rest of the group of the outlaws started shooting me, and then was me against all of them.
There are few instances when this would be socially acceptable. Tony Montana's birthday party, Pablo Escobar's wedding, and a barbecue at Tupac Shakur's house. For filmmaker Gobi Rahimi, this was his audition.
So they made a circle around me, and I didn't give a shit. It's water, and I'm wearing a trench coat, so I just kept firing them all, going all the way around, and they just kept firing me. And then in the middle of it, Tupac broke into the circle, and he said, "That's what I'm talking about. That motherfucker was outnumbered by all you guys, but he didn't put his guard down. That motherfucker kept fighting you."
Tupac Shakur didn't become the most famous rapper in history because he played it safe. He lived in poverty, was surrounded by oppression and adversity, and grew a thick armor to stay alive. But his skills didn't end with survival. They thrived with music. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupniak. Tupac Shakur was born Lassane Paris Brooks in Harlem on July 16, 1971. His parents were members of the Black Panther movement. His mother, Afeni Shakur, got pregnant with Lassane while on bail after being charged for conspiring to set off a race war. She was acquitted the following year when she successfully defended herself in court. She was a talented orator, and she passed her skills down to her son. Gobi Rahimi was a good friend of Tupac's.
Since he had such a turbulent upbringing, both with his mom and her Black Panther past, her fall from grace, her addiction, and never having a solid father figure that was there from jump. I mean, he didn't know who his biological dad was till he was 23.
Afeni raised Tupac and his younger sister Shakia alone. They struggled for money and stability. As a result, they moved around a lot, sometimes living in shelters. When Tupac was a teenager, they lived in Baltimore. He enrolled at the Baltimore School for the Arts. Tupac has said, while he was a student there, it was the freest he ever felt. He thrived at school. Instructors were impressed by his talent and versatility as an actor, a poet, and a singer. While at school, Tupac became friends with actress Jada Pinkett Smith. She has told reporters that when they met, she was a drug dealer, and credited their friendship as a way to survive. The area in Baltimore where the family were living was drowning in crime. Afeni took her family to Marin City, California. It turned out to be rougher than they imagined. Crime and drugs were on every corner. Afeni's addiction became so bad, she and her son sold drugs on street corners to make ends meet. One day, at the age of 17, Tupac met Layla Steinberg in a park. They bonded over Winnie Mandela, and Tupac told her about his poetry and passion for hip-hop. This sparked a friendship, and he convinced her to be his manager. He got his first big break as a roadie and backup dancer for the hip-hop group Digital Underground. He eventually got a chance at the mic, and in 1991 recorded the single Same Song, which featured in the Dan Aykroyd film Nothing But Trouble. Tupac signed with Interscope Records and released his debut solo album, Tupacalypse Now. He was irritated with the critics, saying they were too focused on the violence and drugs that featured in his music, and paid no attention to the caring and more sensitive tracks.
His music moves you, because there's so much passion and so much authenticity in what he says. Whether he's talking about his mom or a baby or a bitch or a hoe, you know what I mean? He doesn't mince words, and he goes balls to the walls. I mean, there was no holding him back. as a song the QD3 Quincy Jones' son produced called Letter to the President. It was a letter to Clinton at the time. And in it, he's like, what do you expect us to do? Look at how we live. Look at where we're at. Help us. The money was important, but he wanted to achieve so much more.
Tupac was on the track to success, but at home, trouble was everywhere. Gang violence was growing, as was police corruption. He was involved in two shooting instances between 1992 and 93. During one shootout, a 6-year-old bystander was killed. Tupac didn't fire the weapon, but he never got over it. He was the embodiment of thug life. He had the tag boldly tattooed across his stomach. Thug Life is an acronym meaning the hate you give little infants f***s up everybody. Tupac explained it as, what you feed us as seeds grows and blows up in your face. In 1994, Tupac was accused and prosecuted for raping a girl in a Brooklyn nightclub. He always maintained his innocence. On November 30th, 1994, the day before the verdict was announced, Tupac and his entourage walked into Quad Recording Studios in Manhattan. They were met in the lobby by armed men. Tupac was robbed and shot 5 times, including twice in the head. He checked himself out of the hospital the next morning so he could attend court and hear the verdict. He didn't want the jury to think the shooting was a publicity stunt. Tupac was a lot of things, but one thing he never was afraid. While Tupac was serving his time in prison, he filled notebooks with poetry and lyrics. He began to appeal the charge, but couldn't raise the $1.4 million he needed in bail. The head of Death Row Records, Suge Knight, offered him the money, but only if he signed with them exclusively. He agreed. While in prison, Tupac married Keisha Morris in 1995. They had only known each other for several months. 5 months after he was released, they annulled, but they remained friends. After his marriage to Morris ended, Tupac began dating Kidada Jones. They met at a nightclub when Tupac apologized for insulting her father, Quincy Jones, for his preference in women. When he returned to California, he became a supernova. He worked tirelessly, fueled by pot, cigarettes, and Hennessy. But once he got into the studio, he was almost prophetic.
There's no one in the recording studio, and he's sitting at the board. He's got a little crust from food here. He smoked enough weed and drank enough Hennessy, and he's basically propping himself up on an arm, and he's got a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and you know, it's like not much of it is the ash. And he's just rocking himself. And the line that he's listening to is, my only fear of death is reincarnation. I use my last breath to save a whole nation, right? And I mean, look, I get chills when I even think about that. I mean, he was the fastest. I've never seen anyone work as fast as him, where he's sitting there, listens to a beat, 20 minutes he's written it, 30 minutes he's done his first track, and in 40 minutes he's done the entire song. Doubles and triples and quadruples and ad-libs and whatevers, and he might do 2-3 songs in a night. I learned very quickly that we had to button everything up and the shit had to be streamlined. So like, you know, instead of doing 8 takes per piece or shot or whatever it was, I'd knock out the 2 or 3, make sure the footage was good, we'd move on. And he loved that. He loved when we moved quickly, efficiently, but if anything ever hit a snag, then he would blow a fuse and then it would be hell to pay and you'd have to figure out how to sort of solve the problem.
While working day and night, he was pouring his profits back into the community. He funded an at-risk youth center, bankrolled South Central sports teams, and set up a helpline for young people with problems. He also ran a kind of orphanage for wayward misfits out of his home. He called them the Outlaws.
It was really a family slash army of people he wanted to have around him. To the best of my knowledge, he never wanted to be alone. He always wanted to have someone there with him. So sense of family was important to him. He did it by surrounding himself with all the dysfunctional people that he possibly had, you know, had around him, but they were his. And as long as he could trust them and they were loyal, that's all that mattered. The Outlaws were genuinely a group of talented rappers that were comprised of a few kids that he grew up with, as well as a few other kids that were brought in by the kids that he grew up with. They were his group, but they were also his security and protection. And they lived with him, or they lived at the house in Calabasas, and they were gonna be the first group. But they all had horrible upbringings. But I also think that it's when you are raised in adversity, and if you make it out of it, and if you're an artist, that's where the best art comes from, is from pain. He was constantly challenging them. Like, for example, you know, he'd give them dictionaries and say, learn 5 words or learn 10 words, or you give them a book, or you need to up your rap. And in the studio, they only had a certain amount of time. Whoever was able to write their rap in time would get on the track. If you didn't, you're out. So the Outlaws probably moved at the regular speed of a rapper, but he forced them to up their game. On set, if they were flaky or if they didn't perform in front of the camera the way they should have, he would reprimand them hardcore, like a drill sergeant or even a mean dad. Some of the Outlaws that I've spoken to over the year, they said that he even had a curfew for them at the house, where he was the only one that could bring girls back. If they wanted to f*** around with a girl, they had to take her somewhere else. The house was the safe spot, and it was the place for them to eat, work, cook, sleep. But it was a sanctuary, and he had house rules. So he really was sort of like a dad for all these orphans. Absolutely. And he schooled them. He told them what to do and how to be in front of the camera, on the mic, in public. He had influence on all facets of their sort of their personas. He named them, you know what I mean?
Coming up, we'll take a look at what it was like being raised by a Black Panther revolutionary. A Life Lived is sponsored by Audible. Audible has the world's largest selection of audiobooks and audio entertainment, including Audible Originals, which are stories created exclusively for audio, including podcasts, documentaries, exclusive audiobooks, and scripted shows that you can't hear anywhere else. With the Audible app, you can listen anytime, anywhere, on any device, mobile, Alexa-enabled, Bluetooth, and so much more. And of course, the great thing about audiobooks, you can listen to them while you're shopping, or in the car, traveling. Basically, anytime you can't read, you can listen with Audible. I'm currently listening to The Testaments, Margaret Atwood's follow-up to The Handmaid's Tale, while I'm pushing my 10-month-old around in the park in a stroller. And the world may not be in such a good place at the moment, but hey, at least it's not Gilead. Because you listen to A Life Lived, Audible wants to give you a 30-day Audible trial. You can choose one audiobook and 2 Audible originals for absolutely free. Just visit audible.com/lifelived or text lifelived to 500-500. That's audible.com/LIFELIVED or text LIFELIVED to 500-500. We're also sponsored this week by HelloFresh. HelloFresh makes it easy for you to cook delicious dinners every time. No planning, no shopping, you just choose your recipes from a weekly menu, and HelloFresh delivers fresh, quality, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes direct to your door. Now, I may have said this once or twice, but I've got a 10-month-old little man at home, and I'm pregnant with a baby, our second, and eating properly and getting my protein in this incredibly changing environment is slightly challenging. I love cooking, and that's why it's been so amazing to get HelloFresh into my life and my kitchen. I mean, these past few weeks, I've enjoyed delicious and nutritious meals like hot honey chicken with barbecue roasted potatoes and buttery broccoli, corn and zucchini risotto, oh, and the sizzling hoisin shrimp and ginger scallion rice and crispy green beans. My goodness. I mean, I'm dribbling just thinking about it. Seriously, HelloFresh has been life-changing. Their menus
They're super quick, they're super easy, and they are super fun to prepare. All the ingredients are responsibly sourced, and the nutritional information is there in black and white. So check out their menus for yourself and get $80 off your first month by heading to HelloFresh.com/LifeLived80 and enter the offer code LifeLived80. That's HelloFresh.com/LifeLived80 and the promo code LifeLived80.
When your parents are members of the Black Panther Party, you're born to be a revolutionary. Even his name, Tupac Shakur, was in honor of an 18th century Peruvian revolutionary. Tupac became the face of a forgotten society and the voice of generations of oppression. And though he was a man with a mission, he was by no means a saint.
He was drinking and he was smoking weed the entire time. If I drank and I smoked as much as he did, I'd be in a perpetual coma. But even given as much as he drank and he smoked, he functioned and had so much energy. And I wonder if the downer of alcohol or the mellowing of weed was what allowed him to maintain some sort of stability. I never saw him sober, so I don't know. You know, I've seen some prison interviews where he's real lucid and sober, but with us, I never saw that. And it's sort of sad, but I think about kind of, again, we talked about how much weight was on his shoulders, and, you know, it just seemed like he had to keep himself in some sort of a walking coma in order to be able to function. So I don't want to be stereotypical and use astrology, but Geminis are always attributed as having many faces or many sides. And I honestly believe he was a true Gemini because his mood could change at the drop of a hat. He was a clown. You know, like, he loved sort of being Scarface or being characters. And, you know, I've got footage of him putting a wig on and playing Rick James in front of everyone behind the scene, you know, doing, she's a super freak, run around with a wig on and everyone's just dying laughing. He did that so much.
He performed many roles as a self-proclaimed thug, rapper, actor, and businessman. He starred alongside Janet Jackson in Poetic Justice, with Mickey Rourke in Bullet, and became friends with Tim Roth while working on Gridlocked. All the while, Tupac had his eyes set on the future. He had big plans, including going solo from Death Row, starting his own production company, and possibly running for office. He said, "In 5 years from now, you won't even recognize me."
In one of our last meetings, he said, "You know, in 6 months, I'm gonna act so mature. I'm done with this dumb I'm done with all the BS. And in fact, you know what? I may one day run for mayor of Los Angeles because the politicians, the police force, and the preachers are the biggest gangs in this country." So to us, it was clear that he wanted off Death Row. He wanted autonomy. He'd built a production company with us, and he'd built a record label with Yasmin Fula and the people that were, you know, on the music side, and he wanted to take over that way. Afeni had once said, after he died, "My son would never bend a knee for anything or anyone." He trusted me, and I felt his trust, and I felt like I was one of his soldiers, and that's why when he got shot, I knew something was going down in Vegas, and when we got there, I was like, "I'm willing to put myself at risk for this guy. I want to stand here and help protect him," because he was otherworldly.
On September 6th, Tupac, Suge Knight, and a few members of the Outlaws went to Las Vegas for the weekend. They started their evening watching a boxing match, and on the way back to their hotel, they got into a fight with a member of a rival gang. It broke up, and they went their separate ways. Later that evening, Tupac and Suge were stopped at a red light when a car pulled up alongside and opened fire. Tupac was shot in the head, chest, hand, and pelvis.
We were at the club that Suge Knight had called 662, waiting for him. And then Nate Dogg came through the crowd, the rapper, and he came up to us and said, Pac and Suge have been shot. So immediately we went to the hospital, and the ER waiting room was littered with Suge Knight's people, his mom and his dad, and his lawyer, David Kenner, and his security guy, Reggie Wright, and a few other people. And then Kadada Jones and Tupac's cousin Jamala were on the payphones crying. And within an hour, the nurse came out, and Suge's mom ran up to her and goes, how's my baby? How's my baby? And the nurse said, ma'am, your son's fine. He got hit with a piece of shrapnel, probably glass. We're going to stitch him up, take him to a private room in an hour. And then she turned to us and she said, unfortunately, Tupac's condition is not the same. He was shot in the lung, the right lung, and it had to be removed. And in the next 12 hours, he's going to go into a series of reparative operations. So I was in touch with his manager, Yasmin Fuller at the time, business manager and auntie. And she sort of said, like, you got to hold fort until we get there. So that was sort of the first day of six nights that I sat the 12 to 8 in the morning watch. Six of the scariest days that I've ever had. He was in an induced coma. There was this white nurse, bless her, she used to come out every night and sort of give me a progress report. Like one night she came out, I think it was 2-3 in the morning, and she was like, that Tupac of yours, he's such a fighter, almost lost him again, gave him 500 cc's of adrenaline or whatever it was, and he came right back. And then she said that they had to put him in an induced coma because every time he came to, he'd pull the plugs and want to get out of bed. I was a part of this security detail to make sure that he's safe, and, you know, we sat our shifts. We all had our shifts. So there's a lot of commotion that happened at the hospital. There were death threats. There were undercover FBI agents, and the police wouldn't cooperate, and we couldn't get ample security for him. Finally, on the sixth night, so the fifth night was the first time that I could muster up the strength to go into his room and see him. The nurse had come out to me and she's like, baby, have you even gotten in there? And I was like, no, I just didn't want to go. And she said, come with me. There was no one there. It was just me in the ER waiting room on the fifth night. I was like 2-3 in the morning. So I went in there and immediately I was taken aback because his head was swollen. It's like twice the size of regular. I don't know, it was water on the brain or blood on the brain or whatever it was. And then he was just draped with a thin cloth, and then most of his body was exposed. And wherever he had a bullet hole, his finger that was missing was wrapped up, and wherever he had bandages, you know, wherever he'd been shot. And I went up to him, and first thing I noticed, I put my hand on his arm to say a prayer, and it was ice cold. And I said my little prayer, and then I left. And that was the last time I ever saw him. I had heard on the sixth night that he was 13% better. And I don't know if that was 13% of 100% or if he was at 50% and it was just 13% better than that. But by the sixth day, the Nation of Islam had showed up. All these Fruit of Islam dudes came in, their bow ties, and they're all standing around and acting all, you know, we got this covered. After 6 days, you know what I mean? I was like, all right, great, f-ing great. So I sort of felt redundant at that point. I sort of felt like I had done all that I could do for him, and he would understand if I had to go back to take care of Tracy and work. So I left. And then the next day, we were on the way to set, all of us. And that's when, back then, Theo from 92.3 The Beat came on and said, Tupac Shakur passed. And we sort of were all just silent. And his passing was the end of many things. But for me, it was the beginning of a long depression. I hadn't really been affected by anyone in my life the way I had by him, and he wasn't even my blood. Tupac gave me meaning. And when he died, it sort of felt like my meaning went with him. He was a huge loss for me, even though I didn't know him for years, but that supernova burnt a footprint on my heart.
Tupac Amaru Shakur was cremated the day after his body was released from hospital. He delivered 11 platinum albums, 4 during his career, and 7 after his passing. So far, Tupac has sold more than 75 million records worldwide. As of September 2017, the Recording Industry Association of America listed Tupac as the 44th top-selling artist of all time.
He was a brilliant genius with a broken heart. And I think that he had a tremendous amount of pain that was attributed to his life, but also to the injustices that he and his race and people outside of his race, people of color, have been exposed to. He was a supernova that burnt out quick because his body didn't have, or his emotions didn't have the skill set to control the nuclear reactor that was inside him. And the only way that it could do what it could do was just go out in a splash the way he did, you know, or blast, I should say. I honestly believe that for African Americans, people of color, and all disenfranchised people around the world, he's got so much to teach. I think his legacy is incomplete right now. He might have some unreleased music, but I don't think his music is as important as who he was. I think who he was, how he affected people, what he taught them, what he shared with them, what they observed, that's his legacy.
Gobi Rahimi continues to make original video content with his company, Static Free Films. You can see his work and upcoming projects on staticfreefilms.com. Next time on A Life Lived.
The meeting was with producer on a new show that they were working on. And, you know, the meeting runs about 10 minutes before somebody comes in the room after 10 minutes and says, "Sandy, where did you park?" I said, "Oh, I got this great space. It was right next to the main door. It was so cool. I guess it was my lucky day." And the person said, "Sandy, you parked in Stan Lee's parking spot."
Find out the origin story of a man who went from office runner to Marvel mastermind as we open the curtain to see the omnipotent editor Stan Lee in action. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak, assistant produced by Paige Waller. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.